Asian students had the highest overall average, followed by whites, then Latinos. Black students had the lowest average scores. The biggest overall drop was in the writing section of the SAT, which was introduced in 2006. Students with the best scores were more likely to have taken honors or advanced placement courses in high school. Blacks and Latinos were the least likely to have access to these courses. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
One of the biggest commuter railroads in the country has a massive outage. Metro North ferries tens of thousands of commuters into New York City. Connecticut authorities say there has been a power disruption and about a third of the regular service is available between Stamford, Connecticut and downtown New York City. Officials say they're trying to find alternative power sources to use on the rail line. Utility Con Edison warns it could take 2 or 3 weeks to repair it. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Charles Schwab, working to help investors take control of their financial future. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com.
WILL programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2014 lecture series presents Responding to Global Terrorism, Provocation, Retaliation, and Deterrence with Martin Crenshaw this Thursday at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is a political roundtable edition of the program, and we've gathered three experts on Illinois state politics around a virtual roundtable to look at some current issues in Springfield and at the coming 2014 election. The General Assembly is in recess until the fall veto session begins on October 22nd, and the March 18th primary is 6 months away, so now is a relatively calm time to figure out some of the more tangled issues of our state with minimal anxiety. And to help me do that, I'd like to welcome Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief at Illinois Public Radio. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning, Jim.
And Bernard Schoenberg, a longtime political columnist for the State Journal Register in Springfield. Bernie, are you there?
I am here. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. And David Yepsen, down in Southern Illinois, he's the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at SIU Carbondale and a former longtime reporter, editor, and columnist at the Des Moines Register.
It's good to be with you, Jim.
And we'll be moving pretty quickly from topic to topic, so if you have a question on something we're talking about, don't hesitate to call or email. We're at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. I wanted to take a quick review of the coming primary races, even though, of course, people are still out there circulating their petitions. They haven't turned them in yet. There may be people who haven't announced yet. But when we look at the statewide races, I'm just wondering on what does it mean as far as who is running? Right now, the way things are set, the hot contested primary races for statewide offices seem to be all on the Republican side. Amanda, do I have my scorecard correct there?
You do have your scorecard correct. There is actually an individual that is potentially going to challenge Governor Pat Quinn. He says he is. That's T.O. Hardeman, who is the former director of Ceasefire out of Chicago. That's an anti-violence organization. Somewhat ironically, his critics would note, he actually was left that organization after he was accused of domestic abuse of his wife. So he was let go from Ceasefire, and we haven't seen a whole lot of campaign contributions from him. As you noted, we haven't actually had petitions turned in yet. And after petitions are turned in, candidates also still need to successfully make it through any potential challenges to those signatures. For example, if, you know, you can't read somebody's name or somebody signed from the wrong area, what have you. So it remains to be seen. Nonetheless, he's not seen as a real contender in the race. So yes, that does leave, particularly on the governor's side, four candidates from the GOP. Also, there are several candidates running for treasurer. On the opposite party, there are no challenges to any of the statewide candidates for Democrats.
Now, some of those are incumbents, not all of them. I think Mike Frericks is running for state treasurer. He's a state senator from Champaign, but he is also, he's the only one.
Exactly. He is the only non-incumbent there, kind of. You also have Lieutenant Governor Sheila Simon, who is, I guess, an incumbent in that she holds statewide office, but not an incumbent in the office of which she is seeking. She wants to now be comptroller. That was seen early on as an indication of maybe not a lot, a groundswell of support from Democrats for Governor Pat Quinn. Who knows if she would have made the same decision now, because she, presuming she will make it out of the primary. Again, no challenge, and no challenge on the Republican side for incumbent comptroller Judy Barr Topinka. That will be a standoff between two of the kind of, in a sense, more popular statewide candidates, both, again, women. So we'll see how that turns out. But who knows? And I guess that's kind of an interesting thing to look back on. Had Sheila Simon known when she declared she was not going to keep on as Pat Quinn's lieutenant governor that Attorney General Lisa Madigan was going to back out from challenging him for the governorship, would she maybe have wanted to stay on? Who knows? I don't think would ever say that or admit to it, even if that were the case. But all of this campaign really has come down to a lot of what Attorney General Lisa Madigan's decision was and a very lucky Governor Pat Quinn.
And that's, two people who decided not to run for governor, Lisa Madigan and also Bill Daley from Chicago. Bernie, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts here. If these people had been running, everything would have been a lot busier, not just for the governor's race on the Democratic side, but other offices, too.
Yes, well, I'm personally thankful to Bill Daley because it means less work for me. But that's a very self-centered thing to say. I will say it is interesting that Bill Daley had hinted in the past that he was going to be a potential candidate for governor one or two times, and each time it had not gone very far and he had backed out. I remember speaking to him at a Springfield event once about that. He didn't really know. I don't think he knew me. I came up to him with my reporter tape recorder in hand. He did not seem comfortable in this situation. And if we take him at face value, and I think for the most part we can, that he got out of the race for governor, in addition to the fact that he was not getting party support along the way and that he was having to campaign downstate, he said that he realized how hard this was and how he didn't want to spend the next 5 years of his life and then potentially 9 years with two terms as governor campaigning and fixing the state. So it's a hard thing to do to run. It seemed like Bill Daley was going to do it this time because what changed in his life was he no longer had a brother who was mayor of Chicago, so he could legitimately say that conflict is gone. But he did find out that, this campaigning thing is difficult, and Pat Quinn seems to thrive on that side of things as he has been campaigning for various public policy issues since his days with the quote-unquote Coalition for Political Honesty that he and his brother Tom were a big part of 30 years ago as they were fighting for things like reducing the size of the Illinois House and creating the Citizens Utility Board that fights utility companies to try to keep rates down. So, yes, things would be a lot busier if Bill Daley were in. Pat Quinn is now gets to be just governor, but also gets to be the focus of all the Republicans' ire, as they can all aim their barbs at him, as they have anyway, as they campaign. But given that there are four potentially strong Republican candidates for governor, what the GOP has to watch out for is that circular firing squad syndrome that affected their party last time, when you have too many candidates that knock each other down during the primary and then they are damaged. They've spent too much money and they're damaged goods for the general election. Or in the case last time, they let a candidate from downstate, Bill Brady, who was not really getting the state senator from Bloomington. He became the nominee with less than 21% of the primary vote because of that situation. And so he did not have the innate strength in the Chicago region that he needed, so he was trying to build that at the end, but Pat Quinn was able to come through. So just as you say, have alluded to already, and as Amanda said, the Republicans have the big fight right now. They will aim a lot of vitriol at the Quinn administration and the Democrats that run the legislature and the problems the state has, but they need to be careful not to be too critical of each other as this goes on, because some of those things stick.
Well, and to that end, Bernie, I feel like we have to wonder if Bill Daley would have backed out had he gotten more traction from the Democrats. And what you saw from the Democratic Party was that it ended up not being a situation because Daley backed out before the State Central Committee, headed by House Speaker and Democratic Party Chairman Michael Madigan, called for a statewide slating that Quinn was expected to clinch. So you have irony there because Quinn still professes to be the outsider, and that's how he got his political start. And yet he was getting the inside track on, lo and behold, a Daley, of course, Illinois' kind of first family of the political machine there. Regardless, you saw Democrats coalescing around a candidate. They came together around, for example, Mike Frericks, a downstate candidate getting support from upstate. He's basically been, you know, it's clear he's been looking to run statewide basically since before he even got a seat in the state Senate. But they organized for that. And on the Republican side, you continue to see time and time again, they're saying, no, this is good. This is healthy for the party. We want to have a lot of candidates. But as Bernie indicated, that is what has gotten the party into trouble in the past. You haven't had the perhaps strong leadership from a chairman. You continue to have a division between the conservative faction of the party and the more moderates. It continues to cause trouble for Republicans as they try and get very conservative and go to the right in order to get a primary nomination. And then they have to go forward into a general election where Illinois has seen more of an appetite for moderate Republicans if they as statewide winners. So, as Republicans see this as a chance, Quinn, it's, again, kind of an interesting thing where he has captured the nomination, basically, of the Democratic Party, but yet isn't really liked by a lot of the Democrats. The Speaker calling the Democratic State Central Committee to slate and to endorse him and to back the governor. And yet, when you speak to many of the rank-and-file Democrats, especially members of the legislature, they're not very fond of the governor. They don't think he's done a great job as a leader. They're upset that he has vetoed out their salaries. So he is getting the push of the party, even though they don't like him. And then there are a lot of Republicans that have different sources of support. And it does, as Bernie said, gets into this trouble where they were going to have to use up not only a lot of bashing one another that will carry over into the general election, but a lot of money when Quinn wouldn't have to really spend a lot of his campaign cash anyway, because he is very good at using the government kind of side of things. I'm not necessarily alleging any wrongdoing there or anything. However, he is very much all over the state with press releases and spending money using his incumbent status to do that. But furthermore, Republicans, as they try and fundraise and outraise each other, are having to spend that cash in the primary.
Well, I'm wondering, and David Yebsen, let me pose this to you. We have a bunch of GOP gubernatorial candidates who could take up a lot of energy that the Republicans need for the November election. But at the same time, we have a Democratic slate, which is pretty much uncontested for the statewide races. They're not going to have to be doing much work for the primary. Meanwhile, the top of their ticket is not that popular within the party. Could that hurt them when they come out into the general election against whoever the Republican nominees are?
Well, I think there is a danger in Democratic complacency here. First of all, you know, the conventional wisdom is the Republicans will have this bitter primary and they will be a circular firing squad. And that could happen. It has certainly happened in the past, and the Republican Party nationally is having some strains in its ranks over what its message is and how it wants to offer itself to the electorate. But at the same token, if they can conduct this primary in such a way that they're focusing their attacks on Pat Quinn and an argument over who among them is best suited to run against him, I actually think that this primary could be healthy for the Republican Party, could put some energy into it, certainly attract a lot of media attention to counter what Amanda was just talking about here, which is Pat Quinn's use of the bully pulpit to always be in the news, to be campaigning. Republicans can be out there making a little bit of news. Bernie will be forced to be covering the Republicans all the time and not have to worry about the Democrats, and so they'll generate a lot more media attention that way. One parenthetical comment, you're talking about Bill Daley. I'm still surprised that someone with the last name of Daley would indicate that he wasn't sure what he was getting into when he started running. I mean, I'm just dumbfounded by that. I mean, I thought politics was in their genes, and it still surprises me as to how he so quickly got out of this race, because there are a number of Democrats who I've talked to down here who were really disappointed in that. Pat Quinn is not very popular in a lot of downstate areas.
And I would say anybody named Daley would not be very popular in a lot of downstate areas either.
No, and a lot of them were having a little heartburn over that when Lisa Madigan got out, and they thought that was going to be their only choice. I think it's going to be interesting to watch Pat Quinn use this time to kind of heal the party. It's been pointed out he's not very popular inside the party with a lot of people, so he's got a little time here to heal some wounds. I think a lot of Democrats, particularly in the public employee unions, are probably feeling a little bit like Franklin Roosevelt in 1937, who was getting a lot of grief from a Democratic U.S. senator from Georgia. He made the comment that, well, he may be an SOB, but he's our SOB. And I think a lot of Democrats are going to be having to swallow hard and come behind and support Pat Quinn.
Well, it's not too late. And, I went to looked up the Democratic primary on Wikipedia, and they mentioned some potential candidates still out there, like David Hoffman, who was on the Illinois Reform Commission, and Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, and a few others. Do you hear anything about anybody trying to make a jump in while there's still time?
Well, Senator Raul certainly was thinking about it.
But he jumped out. He has said he's not going to run.
Right, but my point is, yes, the deadlines are a ways away, but as a practical matter, I think it's very difficult to put together the organization and the money that you would need to make a credible effort.
Okay, this is Focus, and I'm Jim Meadows, and we are talking Illinois politics with David Yepsen of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, Bernie Schoenberg of the State Journal Register, and Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio. I want to look over the Republican candidates, and we have some pieces of audio from each of them. The four Republican candidates for governor have all made some beauty contest appearances downstate. I think there was one in Paxton, and there was one in Urbana in Champaign County on September 16th that we were able to cover. And let's listen first to the nominee of from 2010, and that's State Senator Bill Brady. Here's a bit of his remarks.
Ladies and gentlemen, businesses are afraid to make an investment in Illinois. They're afraid not only because of what Barack Obama and Obamacare is doing to this country and this state, but they're afraid because of what Pat Quinn and Mike Madigan and John Culleton and the Chicago politicians have done to cripple our economic opportunity. It doesn't have to be that way, but it is. We have the second highest unemployment of any state in the nation. We have the highest per capita deficit of any state in the nation. The highest per capita unfunded pension liability of any state in this nation. We have some of the poorest performing secondary and elementary schools, and it doesn't have to be.
Senator Brady was fought a close race. He almost beat Governor Quinn in 2010, but of course he did not. Amanda Vinicky, do you think there's any chance of, if it's a Quinn versus Brady, of things being different this time?
It's hard to make that prediction. I would hesitate to do so at this point. I definitely think that, as you talked about, that you saw Brady as a somewhat weak candidate last time around statewide. He is very much a conservative Republican. He's tried to veer, I think, a little bit less so on that side. For example, going along with the ability to give undocumented immigrants the ability to get a driver's license, he was part of that. But he nonetheless is very much trying to remain to the right. You saw that with his lieutenant governor choice as well. And so from that perspective, I think that you could see Brady being very successful again in the primary. His challenge, I think, coming to running statewide, as we talked about, Democrats may not love Pat Quinn, but they will probably go forward and back him. It's more the people that aren't hardcore Democrats, that aren't maybe hardcore union members, the swing voters, exactly, that would be able to be swayed. And there was, I think that you could see some difficulty for Bill Brady. And I think Republicans acknowledge that. They realize that. You look at who is giving support to whom, and a lot of the Republican insiders, the big money folk, are not going along with Brady this time.
Well, let me go to another candidate, and this is the other downstater in the race, State Treasurer Dan Rutherford. Here's a bit of his remarks.
I'm going to be looking at agriculture being a place that we're going to be able to do things to help creative and value added. I'm going to look for Illinois to be a place that we're not going to be embarrassed about and have our head down and avoid eye contact when we talk to people from different states.
That's Dan Rutherford. Bernie Schoenberg, he's certainly been popular as state treasurer. Can you see him making a credible run for governor?
I think he's a credible candidate. I'm hoping your listeners are hearing more than us over the phone because the clips aren't coming through, but that's fine. I have known Dan Rutherford since he lives in Shenandoah now, and he lived in Pontiac years ago, and he became the student body president at ISU in about 1977, and I was covering that for the Bloomington Pantograph at the time. So he then was in the Thompson administration. He was in business for 25 years with ServiceMaster, had a good corporate position in addition to being a legislator for many years before being treasurer. And he has built up a network of friends around the state and employees through the treasurer's office. There's a lot of political people who have joined his staff. He has like a, I think they call it a logistics team at the treasurer's office, and I think there are six people on it who do things that include scheduling where the treasurer of the state of Illinois will be. And a lot of these people come out of campaigns. So there's like a Springfield alderman is one of them, Frank Lesko. So, and when Dan Rutherford comes and speaks, for example, to the very strong Republican organization of Sangamon County, his speech is peppered with pointing out people in the room and naming them. So he is someone who has built up a network. He is knowledgeable. He is somewhat moderate on some issues.
He sounds like the George H.W. Bush of this race.
Well, you know, there's a possibility, although he's, George H.W. dives out of airplanes, and Dan Rutherford also does scuba diving all around the world. So he also has actually, potentially problematic, but I think he thinks it helps him, this tremendous social media presence. He puts everything on Facebook, like where he's working out in the morning and how many miles he's doing on the treadmill and what movie he's watching. He even once posted a picture of himself changing a toilet seat and discussing how he's trying not to get his tie in the water. So all of
complete with the picture, not even just discussing. It was also photographic evidence.
I did just a couple of column items about why is he doing this stuff on Facebook. He seems very touchy about it, but he has clearly got a database that has him in touch through social media and other things, lists of voters he sends letters to congratulate them on, for example, the Jewish holidays. I happen to know we get them at my house. So he's got this network. He has had annual fundraisers in Chicago for years. And, you know, he was the head of international business in the Jim Thompson administration for the Department of Commerce. So he has knowledge of state government. He also voted when he was in the Senate. He was, I believe at the time, the only Republican to vote for civil unions.
Although he has since then come out against same-sex marriage.
He says that that's a religious thing, and he does make the distinction. And I think that may be the realism of what you're doing when you're trying to win a Republican governor primary. But yes, that is correct. He was for civil unions, remains for them, but does say that he is not for same-sex marriage. So it's an interesting thing. He also picked Steve Kim, who was the attorney general candidate and is a Korean-American, I believe, for his running mate. And he has talked a lot about expanding the base of the Republican Party and how he got in his vote, I think it was 22 or 23% of either the Chicago or the Cook County vote, so that he can reach out to other groups that are not traditional Republican voters. So he has all that stuff going on for him. We have to see if he, you know, makes it through. As someone with a voting record for years in the legislature and as someone in charge of programs in the treasurer's office that you can say are good or you can say are spending money here and there that you may not want. For example, he does very well getting his name around and getting his staff and himself around with this iCash program where, you know, banks have dormant accounts, and there's money that you can get. Check the iCash website through the state treasurer's office and find your money. And he's given away, you know, millions and millions of dollars from this, and that helps. But they also spent a lot of money to revamp the website and to advertise the program, so I can see the other candidates, if they have resources like Bruce Hunter, attacking him for that. So, yes, he's a legitimate candidate. He understands state issues. He knows everybody, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, you just mentioned Bruce Rauner. Let's go over to him. That's actually skipping in our sequence of sound bites to number four, but he is the non-politician, at least non-politician up till now, and this is just a few remarks from him in Urbana.
I'm going to run to accomplish four things for you, people of Illinois, four things. More jobs, lower taxes, better schools, and term limits on every politician in Springfield.
And that's more jobs, lower taxes, better schools, and term limits are the things that he's been hitting. Bruce Rauner is almost seems like, I don't know if spoiler is the right word. David Yepsen, how do you think he does coming from the outside?
Well, I think he potentially has a lot of upside. I mean, he has a lot of upside potential. He has a huge bank account. He is personally wealthy. He can self-fund the best campaign of the year. That counts for a lot in this game. His ability to message will far outstrip what the other candidates can offer. But that said, you know, wealthy candidates sometimes don't do all that well in statewide races. The skill sets that you have to be a successful entrepreneur and a successful business person often are not the same ones that you have to succeed in politics. Politics is a collegial thing. It's building coalitions. Entrepreneurs are hard chargers, and they're self-motivated, and sometimes they can irritate people. You have success stories of wealthy people succeeding. The governor of Florida is a good example. But you also have examples of where they, at some point, make a mistake because they're not fluent enough in politics, they're not conversant enough in who they have. So the thing to watch for there is whether his money is an asset that carries him through, or whether he makes a mistake that costs him the election. I think Republicans looking around for somebody who can self-fund are going to have found their candidate, and there is some indication that he is getting a lot of support out of the business community.
And let me go to our final candidate, and that's State Senator Kirk Dillard. Bill Brady lost a close race to Pat Quinn in 2010 in the general election. Senator Dillard lost, I believe, an even closer race in the Republican primary to Senator Brady, but he's making another try of it. He was in the Edgar administration, and he touches on that in this statement.
Somebody go, what are we going to do about Mike Madigan? We're going to do the same thing that we did in the Edgar administration with Mike Madigan. We're going to make him the minority leader. He became the minority leader when I was the governor's chief of staff. And we also won every constitutional office statewide. So I am the electable Republican. I know how to make a Democratic legislature do things it's not in its DNA to do, like live within its means.
So we have Senator Dillard saying that, well, when the Edgar administration plus me was in power, Mike Madigan was the minority leader, at least for a couple of years, and we won our constitutional offices, and I am the electable Republican. Is Kirk Dillard the electable Republican, Amanda?
You know, he is getting a whole lot of support from the members of the General Assembly, from, for example, former Governors Edgar and Thompson. Kind of the political establishment is very much behind Kirk Dillard. They think that he is moderate enough. You heard for years, actually, after the last election, that from Republicans and Democrats alike, Democrats unhappy with Pat Quinn, if only Dillard had been the nominee, things would be so different, because the wisdom was that he would have been able to beat Pat Quinn. It was just a matter of, again, getting out of that primary, as we talked about earlier in the program.
And could he
that
really?
That said, I'm not sure. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
And could he really push those Democrats over at the State House around like he claims and get them to come up with something that he wants.
I'm not quite sure, because the Democrats have pretty healthy majorities in both the Senate and in the House, historic majorities, in fact. And you see a lot of strong leadership, of course, from Speaker Madigan and President Cullerton. That said, there are many who've been around politics who say that things can be better, and actually Democratic General Assembly leaders get along better with a Republican governor. They can kind of work together, or at least blame one another and come to some sort of happy medium. I just think at this point you've seen some of the business community shy away from Dillard because they are such fans of Bruce Rauner. And so Dillard has lost some of that momentum. He's also lost because he was not successful the last time around, not quite the same excitement is being built for him. And while, again, he really seems to have most of the legislators and the people who are really, you know, in the know and in the Capitol right now backing him, that's not necessarily seen these days as an advantage with the state going how it is. Plenty of people saying, you know, Bruce Rauner, what does he know? He's going to come in. He wouldn't hire, for his venture capitalist firm, he wouldn't hire somebody who'd never done that before. What's he going to come in and do? And a lot of fear with that. Rauner sees that as an advantage. Dillard saying, no, I know how to work the system. That is very much true. Again, I just don't know how much voters at this time, where they're celebrating, many of them, that legislators aren't getting paid for their work, are going to see a lot of experience as a member of the General Assembly as an advantage.
Okay. In a moment, we're going to talk about an issue which could be an election issue, but certainly an issue right now, and that's pension issues. But I want to run past you folks a tweet we just got in from Taylor, and he's wondering if certain national issues come up in any way in state politics. Taylor's particularly concerned about the NSA leaks, issues of privacy. Is this anything that anybody thinks about when they're talking politics in Springfield? Bernie?
I think that there are some national social issues that may work their way into the campaign because I'm not sure the privacy issue is going to be the paramount one because I haven't heard that discussed much on the state level at this point. I do know that other states with Republican governors in recent years have been doing things like what they just did in Texas, passing laws that would cut back on abortion as much as possible. That, of course, was a situation with a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. That has happened in some other states. So I think, and I do believe that in the 2010 race in Illinois, one of the differences people note about why Pat Quinn was able to pull it out over Bill Brady right at the end was suburban women who were scared by the very pro-life attitude of Bill Brady. I actually asked Bill Brady about this at his Springfield Legis, his announcement tour. He said, well, you know, Roe v. Wade is the federal law. Governors don't have much to do with that. That has been what people have said for years, but you see that kind of issue in other states. So I think issues like that will continue to be, particularly from outside groups like the pro-choice group that sent out a lot of pro-Pat Quinn stuff or anti-Bill Brady stuff last time. Those issues will also be part of this. And I'm sure that given the fact that Republican has been trending more blue, more Democratic in recent years, Republicans will be talking a lot about trying to keep the focus on fiscal problems under the Democrats who have, you know, given our state a high unemployment rate and a bad bond rating and billions of dollars in debt. And let's get someone in there who is smarter with the numbers who can fix this. Democrats might talk more, or let outside groups talk more about some social issues.
You know, I just want to add to something Bernie just said. I
think David.
The key for all of these Republicans, and you're already seeing them try to do this, is to be conservative enough in this primary to get that nomination without being so conservative that they scare moderate and centrist voters. And we did see that in 2010, the same electorate that elected Mark Kirk to the U.S. Senate elected Pat Quinn to governorship. And if you look at where that occurred, it was in the suburbs with women voters, just a few percentage points. And so Bill Brady today, he sends a coded message to the conservatives by picking a Tea Party candidate as a running mate. And then he can make his comments about issues by sounding more moderate. Bruce Rauner talks about business, but he also bashes unions. That's good red meat for conservatives. without alienating centrist voters who are ultimately going to decide this thing. And so I think that's the thing to watch. Who is doing the best job of courting the conservatives without alienating moderates, and particularly women in the suburbs?
Well, let me take a short break right now. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the pension situation and whether anything is moving towards coming up with a resolution to that big question. This is Focus on WYLL.
On the next Fresh Air, as Breaking Bad nears its conclusion, we bring you a real story about meth. Journalist Jonah Engel talks about his article, Merchants of Meth, How Big Pharma Keeps the Cooks in Business. It's published in Mother Jones. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for Focus comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
We're back with a political roundtable edition of Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and I'm discussing Illinois politics with Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio, Bernard Schoenberg of the State Journal Register, and David Yepsen of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute. If you have any questions on state politics, the number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL. We're at will-talk@illinois.edu and on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. Amanda Vinicky, you just filed a feature report for Illinois Public Radio on the subject we're talking about now, and that is pensions. And my question had I had been wondering is, you know, I haven't heard from the that joint legislative
conference committee.
Thank you. And are they getting anything done, and are they near a solution? And I'm getting the impression from looking at your report is they're not in a really big super hurry.
Yeah, I guess the answer to that would be kind of, maybe, sort of. That you see members of the committee very hesitant to put any sort of deadline or give a date, seeing as they've passed those before. They continue to say that they're working through issues, that they're hopeful for a solution, that they think they are getting close. And really, they continue to be fixed on a basic program, the outline of which we've known about for at least a month. Even, I think, the committee, when the actual leak of the document was put out, like I said, about a month ago, that had already been something that the committee was looking at for a couple of weeks. And that relies on foregoing the very tough elements and, for example, raising the age upon which somebody can retire and still draw full pension benefit that were included in the House plan, favored by House Speaker Mike Madigan, but letting go of the trade-offs that Senate President John Cullerton had said were necessary in order to pass constitutional muster and that were part of the less aggressive pension overhaul that had union backing that passed out of the Senate and led to this full stalemate. So what they've come up with is a plan that they say would continue to give retirees cost of living adjustments, but no longer the 3% compounded COLAs that come every year. This would actually be tied to the cost of living. What has yet to be decided is, for example, any sort of parameters on that. Will there be a cap upon which those cost of living adjustments would be put forward? It would also call, kind of, I guess, in yes, giving a bone to retirees, they're putting less of their paychecks toward retirement benefits. So that's the same basic tenet that, again, the committee has been talking about for a while, but it doesn't seem like that is really gaining a whole lot of support when presented to rank and file members, particularly on the Republican side. They don't think it goes far enough. House Speaker Mike Madigan hasn't given an opinion. He just says it has to be meaningful, and that's the only thing he would consider because he still likes the plan that passed out of the House. Reading between the lines, which is very hard to do with him, one might say that that means that the plan that has come out of the pension committee isn't meaningful enough, seeing as he didn't seem to categorize that as such, but I'd be hesitant to really go that far. So really, in a sense, we have perhaps another stalemate, but one that the committee is continuing to work through and is hopeful about presenting, coming to some sort of agreement, but they're not there yet.
Well, a stalemate except for one thing, and that is Governor Quinn has postponed the legislative salaries for the General Assembly until they do something on this subject. Now, that mandatory veto is up before a judge right now. I understand he's supposed to make a ruling by sometime next week. If Judge Cohen rules that, well, this is none of my business, the governor is in his the governor is able to do this, and the salary postponement stand. Bernie, do you think that will focus the attention of people in the General Assembly?
I'm not sure what their next step is. If the judge does rule that the governor did okay here, because there's really wide disparity of view on this. A lot of people, good government types, think what Pat Quinn did here was a terrible thing because it sets the precedent that, well, anytime the governor has an issue that he doesn't like the way the legislature is going, he can just withhold their pay. And, of course, you know, the legislative leaders who have gone to court say that you can't change the level of pay according to the Constitution in the middle of a term, so this is not legal. And, of course, the governor's people say, well, we have control of the purse strings. I cannot see any immediate way that the legislators want to come in and, for example, override that veto, because then that's a terrible vote, because then the government haters out there, and, of course, we know that that gets whipped up a lot in election time and pretty much 24/7 on cable stations these days too, will say, you know, they're just voting for their own salary and they haven't solved the problem, and the governor can continue to bash them. So I guess I don't know what the next step would be. It certainly would focus attention on it. By the way, the other side is the governor making this action seems to have caught the public's fancy. He seems to have some popular support for this idea of withholding legislators' pay, and he says he's not taking his own paycheck either, which technically I'm not sure. I think they have to give it to him, and he's giving it back or something. So not sure what the next step would be, but it is a kind of a Hail Mary he did. It's odd that politically he might benefit both ways, because if nothing happens, he'll say he tried to put pressure, and if something happens, he'll say, look, they caved to my pressure, all of which is distasteful to members of the General Assembly. Many of whom are working on deadline, are working toward a solution to a very difficult problem, and they think clearly.
Without any help from him, they would argue.
Yeah, he didn't even go to like one of their meetings shortly before a deadline he had set, and you know, they can say that the deadlines are unrealistic and we need to, you know, research these numbers and find out actuarially what each plan would mean. It's a difficult problem. So.
Well, if nobody is able to agree, there are certainly proposals out there, apparently three of them now, but if nobody is able to come to an agreement, aren't they just handing the Republicans a big stick to beat them with in the coming election?
Yes, is the short answer.
Yes, David.
And that's where Democrats, I mean, we come full circle here, and we're back to the politics of this thing. The game has changed. Pat Quinn doesn't need to be beating up the legislature right now. The best thing that could happen to him is for that judge to rule against him. He can say he tried, the legislators can get their pay, and they can start working together. They can't solve the pension problem, but they can at least try to take some steps that look like a resolution is there. And they can move on and move this discussion on to other issues, because right now the Democrats are in charge. They're accountable, and Republicans will be holding them accountable. That's why there's not going to be any Republican support for any solution on the pension issue. They need the issue. And Democrats need to come together and realize they're either going to hang together or they're going to hang separately. And that could happen, because there's a real danger for Democrats in this election that part of their base vote simply stays home. I'm talking about some labor people who are very upset with Pat Quinn, young voters who were there in a presidential year for Barack Obama. I'm on a college campus. I can tell you they don't care about politics now. And voters from minority groups the turnout will fall off there. If that happens to Democrats, you're going to see Republicans winning a lot of races by very small margins in low turnout elections. So what Democrats have to do with this pension issue is to set aside their personal animosity, come up with some, at least some solutions that get us on a path to resolution so they can focus the agenda on other subjects that are politically better for them and put the Republicans on the defensive.
And if they're not able to do that, and a few other things fall into place, could 2014 be the year that Republicans make a real recovery in Illinois politics?
Oh, I think it's a Democratic state, and so it may be impossible to have a real recovery. But voters, our polling shows and other polls show, voters are so angry with what's going on that if Republicans can avoid a bloody primary and can come together with a positive message and not scare people, you know, load the cannon, because voters could very easily say, the Democrats have had their turn, you know, this is like England, they're going out, and we'll put the outs in, and we will try something else here. That could happen.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions on state politics for Amanda Vinicky, David Yepsen, and Bernie Schoenberg. The number is 1-800-222-9455. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. In the last few minutes, I wanted to touch on something which is not an immediate issue, but it's an issue that's always out there. And David Yepsen, I know from your experience covering Iowa politics, you, I think, have a special perspective on that. And that's the idea of how redistricting is handled in the state. There's a group out there called Change Illinois, which made a push, I think, last spring, trying to drum up support for reform in both redistricting and campaign financing. In redistricting, they're looking at some sort of nonpartisan or bipartisan model for changing the way that state legislative and congressional districts are drawn in Illinois. Right now, it is pretty partisan, and with the Democrats in control, they're very Democrat-favoring districts. They do things differently in Iowa, I understand, and with understanding that with a nonpartisan professional staff coming up with a proposal and sending that to the legislature to vote on. Do I have that correctly?
Yeah, what they do in Iowa is there are nonpartisan staffers who draw the district lines. They pay no attention to the residence of incumbents or the party registrations. But you can make a case that Iowa is so much smaller than Illinois that it may not be a parallel situation. And the parallel situation is maybe what we see in Florida and in California, where you have the citizens commissions recently were approved by voters. And they're doing exactly this. They're letting voters draw the district lines. They're not letting politicians pick their constituents anymore. And it's had an impact in the politics in both states. And I think those are states that might have a better model. They're large states. They have large minority populations. They're irregularly shaped. If they can make citizens' commissions drawing district lines work, I think people in Illinois could make one work here too.
And I know there are people around the state who would like that sort of thing, and even more like it if the other party, if the party opposite from them is controlling things. But is it politically possible to get that sort of bipartisan model in? Bernie, what do you think about this?
I think it's a very tall hill to climb, based on some similar things in the past, like when I just remember a constitutional amendment, you know, to make education, the state actually pay more for education funding. You get lots of organized groups against it. To get a constitutional change like this on the ballot, you need something like 250 or 270,000, David can correct me, signatures statewide. You have to collect really at least twice that much, because the lawyers all look over those signatures and they're very easy to attack through objection once those things are filed with the State Board of Elections. So then you have to get it on the ballot, and then you might have some very powerful interests who will advertise all of the things wrong with this, and you might say you agree or disagree with what they're saying, but as we know in political ads, you know, you can make arguments any way you want, and the spin will be real, and lots of money can go against this.
Bernie's right, and let me add one thing to what he just said. I mean, in addition to a lot of signatures being required and a giant ad campaign against it, this is all in all likelihood going to go to the courts. Illinois doesn't have a regular initiative like other states do. It has to be a narrowly drawn matter that affects the policy and procedure of the legislature. And the courts, which are, you know, run for office too, could very easily throw this idea out, as they did in the mid-90s when somebody was trying, when Treasurer Pat Quinn was trying to enact term limits. The court said you can't do it by referendum. So Bernie's right. It's a tall order for a lot of reasons.
And this won't be the only one on the ballot. We also, of course, have Bruce Rauner's more, I think, popular that will gain traction initiative to limit legislative terms.
Yeah, that is something. Do you think that is something that could actually happen in Illinois?
Just like Governor Pat Quinn's idea of letting go of legislators' salaries, I think it is very popular. As we've said, it is not as if the general public is very proud of, they like their individual legislator, the one that they know and may be able to shake hands with. They don't like politicians at large. So yes, I think that it will be very difficult to have a lot of people really informed on the ins and outs and ups and downs, advantages, disadvantages of term limits. They're going to see term limits, say, heck yeah, and Rauner has the money to put behind it, and we could also see that helping his gubernatorial campaign.
But even Bruce Rauner is going to, if he gets enough signatures for it, he still has to get it through the courts.
Oh yeah,
and that was an impediment in the mid '90s when Pat Quinn tried it. So same hurdle there with term limits as there is with a new redistricting system.
Right, and he's tried to tinker with it to add some elements, including I guess. Is it actually lowering? One of the chambers will have fewer members. I think the Senate would have actually fewer members, and then there would be three House districts per Senate district instead of two as there are now. He's saying that to try to meet that kind of constitutional requirement that David was talking about, to show that it's changing, you know, the way the legislature operates. But we've already heard, for example, Kirk Dillard, another candidate for governor, say that, well, with fewer Senate districts, some of those downstate districts will be giant. You'll have less access to your senator, so you're actually hurting representation in that chamber. So you're going to hear arguments on both sides.
Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it for now. Of course, all these discussions continue, and I hope we can rejoin it again in a future edition of Focus. My thanks to Amanda Vinicky of Illinois Public Radio, Bernard Schoenberg of the State Journal Register, and David Yepsen of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute for explaining the current state of Illinois politics to us. And we welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it at will.illinois.edu/focus, and we're likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Mike Pritchard is our technical director and handles your calls. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Friday on Focus, thinking about the future, sometimes the past, with science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson. He's speaking this afternoon, Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. at the U of I Music Building Auditorium as part of a symposium on science fiction, the arts and humanities, and he'll be our guest on tomorrow's edition of Focus. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. And you can hear Focus over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs and sign up for our free downloadable podcast at will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.
Support for WILL Agriculture comes from Murray Wise Associates, LLC. Land auctions, farm management, financial services, and institutional and corporate real estate. Information on upcoming land auctions can be found at murraywiseassociates.com.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. Here's the way the numbers are trading in Chicago at this hour. At the CME Group, December soft red winter wheat is 5.5 cents higher for the day at $6.76. The March at $6.86, up 5.25. And July at $6.81.25, the harvest month, 4.25 higher. The hard red in Kansas City at $7.06, a penny higher for the afternoon, or rather morning. December futures in the corn pit, $4.52, down 2.75. The March at $4.64.75, 2.5 cents lower. And the May corn, $4.72.75, down 2.75. July contract, $4.79.25. The last trade, down 2.5. In December of next year, that's the 2014 corn, at $4.90.75 a bushel, down 0.5 cent. Beans are trading the nearby November contract at $13.15.75, 6 cents lower. January soybeans, $13.17.5, down 6.5. And the March contract at $12.99.5, down down 6. May futures down 7 at 1276.5. And July contract 1269.25, 5.5 lower. November beans at $11.77 for next year, down 2 cents for the day. Bean meal futures trading at $4.1590. That's down $2.70. And bean oil at $41.75, 7 cents lower. Live cattle futures trading the October at $127.40, 15 cents lower. December at $131, down 27.5. And the lean hogs at $92.65 are down $1.05. You're, of course, listening to WILL AM 580 and WILL FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana. Here's what the weather forecast looks like for the day. Sunny skies, an 84-degree high on an east wind at 6 miles an hour tonight, clear and a low of 51. That east wind will continue at 3 to 6 miles an hour, and then tomorrow, sunny with a high of 82, southeast winds at 3 to 8. Friday night, clear and a low of 56. Saturday, sunny skies and 81. Saturday evening, showers possible. 60% coverage. I'm Todd Gleason.